This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hi there, and welcome to the Best of Out Front.
I have a story to tell.
Out Front.
I'm Elizabeth Hudson in Calgary, Alberta. This is Out Front.
A whore is just a butterfly with legs instead of wings.
And before we begin, I would like a little toast.
Are you going to stand a toast, or do you want one of us to?
Oh, I can't toast myself.
Never stopped you before.
Today, I think I am a grateful person. I love writing. I love gardening. I love my dogs. I love my children. I love my husband. Not necessarily all in that order, of course, but in all probability, the odds were that I should be dead.
I'll have some mushrooms. Go right
ahead. All right. A toast to my mother, who is a great and loving person that has looked after us all for many years and many years to come.
Cheers!
Hey.
In a place where even my thighs could hold no flesh, and my bones were only runestones that clattered and splattered to the pavement. My skull bleached white as I disappeared into the quicksand of the street. If you throw a cat out onto the street, you know, what do you get? You get a feral cat. And truly, I was very feral. I would have frightened myself today. In fact, if I saw my young self on the street, I would cross the street. I lived in a commune at the time. I was probably about 18, and there was about four of us living there, and we partied all the time. This guy came over, this hippie guy. He had some heroin, and he offered it. And I thought, well, what the heck? The first time that drug was pushed into my vein, I knew that was for me. I felt such peace, such comfort, such love, that when it was over, I thought, I want to do this again.
A whore is just a butterfly with legs instead of wings.
Seeking out others who had access to heroin is how I came across my boyfriend, who actually made his living by kicking over drugstores. What can I tell you? I fell really hard for him. When I look back, I think it was love. But we were certainly bound together by the drugs we took. The moment my boyfriend went to jail, I had stolen some drugs to give him while he was being sentenced. And afterwards, I had a terrible beating laid on me by the woman I'd stolen the drugs from. And I thought, this is going to be my life. I don't want this to be my life. I have to get out of here. I have to get away from here. And I phoned my mother and I begged to come home. It was, no, not until you straighten out, not until you hit rock bottom. But I really thought then I had hit rock bottom. I went into a washroom in the Regis Hotel, and I tried to clean myself up, and then I made my way with my face all battered and bruised to the Summit Hotel, where I knew the other junkies in Junkie Corner. Interestingly enough, the woman who had beaten me up for stealing her dope ended up making me an offer of staying with her because the dope that she had, she'd stolen from her dealer. And that's life on the street. It's sometimes defies belief. Issued from the driver in a black sedan, a signal, and once summoned, I strut into the light, where the color and trappings of my costume shine bright. As Eve bit through the red skin of forbidden fruit, watching for glass and razors, so will I. Of course, the supply drugs that she had ran out, and she had been hooking since in between dealings. So she just looked at me and she said, well, she said, you don't have a boyfriend. And there's nobody to supply you with anything, and you owe me anyway, and you're going to have to go out on the street. You're going to have to sell your ass like the rest of us. I went with her. You think that it's unreal, something you would see in the movies. And we stood away from the other girls, down by the beverage block. And it wasn't long before somebody came along. In the beginning, the other women of the street were terrifying to me. They were terrifying to me because they were so aggressive. You have to remember there's only so much business to go around. They didn't like younger competition. Often younger girls were beaten and kicked off the stroll. The only way that you can actually deal with it and deal with them is to become as aggressive and fierce as they are, so that you kind of build up a reputation and that they will grudgingly give you a place and leave you alone. If you're a woman working the street, you know what? You never cry. And that's the surest way to have them turn on you. If I cried, and I did cry sometimes, I was always alone when I cried. I had become a medium in spiked heels, balancing on my crystal-chipped vagina. My cherry red lips swallowed coin and blew life into rented illusions, while behind my crooked smile I was divining the shape of apocalypse, black between my legs. Most pimps don't want a drug-addicted woman because you eat up all the profit. I was an independent, and that's what we called ourselves. And we were, in essence, running our own business, so to speak. It was my money. I earned it. And I spent it the way I wanted to, and that was on drugs. When you're young and you're pretty, you can make a lot of money. I always had a roll in my pocket or in my boot, always. But you put all of it into your arm. In fact, I like to say that's where my RRSP is, all in my arm. I had actually worked the stroll on Christmas. I was the only girl out there working on Christmas. I had gone to score some drugs, and when I was leaving to return to my hotel room, one of the women who had been at the drug pusher's place tried to jump me. And, yeah, I beat the living hell out of her. I could have killed her, actually. I was so angry. I became one of them. I learned the rules. I became one of them. I had become a fierce woman, too.
Behind closed doors and between grimy hotel sheets, naked and alone, fear was always near. With each quick breath, it fluttered free. Fear snapped from black garters and whispered in the bed, rustling, restless, racy. Fear made a home in each new face and in every man's embrace.
I was in a hotel room in Chinatown in Vancouver, in a trick room. Didn't sleep there, I just brought the tricks there. And the guy just exploded with this violence, and he came at me, and we had this hard scrabble, and he was punching me, and oh, I remember he landed such a blow on my head that I didn't think I'd ever be able to hear out of my ear again. And he kept saying, look up at the light. And I knew if I looked up at the light, he planned to knock me out and God knows do what. And I thought, well, I'm not going down without a fight. Like, and I think the other thing that was so frightening was I screamed at the top of my lungs the whole time this was happening, or almost the whole time he was attacking me, and nobody came. Nobody. And there was this horrible, ugly feeling of thinking, this man is going to kill me, and nobody will even know who did it. I'll just be a floater in the river. I think he decided to finish me off somewhere else because he forced me to get dressed. He said, okay, come on, you're coming with me. And he forced me out the door. And I managed to break away from him and run down the hall to the innkeeper. And then I put the innkeeper in between us and we kind of ran around. The innkeeper told him that he would call the police. And so he left. So, yes, that stands out clearly and always in my mind.
Like a cigarette butt, I was tossed from a speeding car, and like a pop can, crumpled and crushed, I stayed. No sirens were heard, no reports, no charges were laid. Only the women of the street moved from the shadows and wailed into the night.
I can remember after I'd been a junkie for some time, looking in the mirror and just actually being quite horrified by what I saw. My skin tones had turned kind of grayish and my cheeks had sunken and my eyes were dull. My hair seemed brittle. I had actually always sort of had a Marilyn Monroe type figure, and I was really just skin over bones. And I really thought as I looked, yes, I am dying, and this is how it looks, and it's a slow death. And then you realize the men just want your youth. It's not you. It's your youth. It was knowing that if I grew old on the street, I would no longer be of much value even there. In a semblance of a smile, my painted lips would part, and the growl of my anger would hush as it crossed my tongue. And so grinning, I prayed my rage could pass through my teeth as vapors unrecognized by the neighbors. Jack was an old hippie friend of mine, and I had known him probably from the time I was 16. And we had hung out together, and just the fact that he found me that day sort of so alone and destitute on Calgary's 8th Avenue Mall and really reached out his hand is one of the miracles of my life. When I first came to Jack's place, I was so out of control, so socially unacceptable that even I can't believe it. I was extremely aggressive and assaulted several of their friends at parties. I would spit. I just did horrible things. I guess because they were men, he and his roommates, they weren't threatened by that when I would suddenly have a rage and start ranting and stomping, and I think they thought it was kind of humorous. But then again, too, they would soothe me, and then I would drop it, and then I would feel badly about how I had acted. So I will be forever grateful. I credit him for saving my life, actually. I credit him for giving me a life. And I married his roommate. So what could be better than that? What could be better than that? That was the next step. The wings of my labels, worthless whore, drug-addicted prostitute, were so deeply embedded that I despaired of ever expunging them. Only my husband stroked them, folded them, and then hid them behind a jacket of respectability. I asked my husband one day, I said, why on earth would you have ever married me? I certainly wasn't good material. I was so angry and full of rage, and I was aggressive, and he just looked at me and he said, yes, but you were also very lost. He knew how lost I was, and he knew that all of these other emotions that I displayed were just shields against how lost and lonely and frightened I truly felt. And he too reached in, and, well, how can you not love somebody who loves you even when you think you're unlovable? But I'm not like other women, I wailed. And my husband advised, just pretend you are. So I began to cover my red canvas and painted rose and quartz on my clip nails. Black and gray covered my frame, and on my lips I brushed peach and mauve. For the true art of pretense is apprenticed and varnished in more muted colors. I became very observant, and I began to observe the women that I ran across and who invited me over for coffee, sort of began to try and model the way they acted. And these women actually had hobbies. And it was like, a hobby? because my whole life had been consumed with drugs. So therefore, I learned from each and every one of them, and I don't even think that they knew that I was learning from them, but I was, how to cook and bake and garden and craft. And I would sit there in wonderment that how fortunate they were that they had never been touched by the kind of violence and horror and evil that I had seen. I did envy that. I really did. But I really wanted to be like them too. I think they kind of knew that something was a little different about me, although I never told anybody about my past. You couldn't have pried that out of my mouth. But they knew there was something different about me. And really, truly, once I was in that world, I knew that I would never, ever again meet anybody who had had the experiences I had. And that I had to learn to live with my psychological isolation. And to understand that, you know, I was never again going to be whole like other women. It was impossible. What I had to do was forgive myself and just try and piece myself back together as best I could. The stain of my youthful prostitution spreads in a crimson pool, spilling over my sons, my daughters, my sisters, my brothers, my mother, my father, and I think now how much better it would have been if I had only given it away for free. I told my children when they were still very young, probably they were about 9 and 11, when I told them, and again, I was driven by fear. I was so terrified that some cruel person might sometime tell them. I wanted them to be prepared. So I think that they were young enough that they just accepted it, because I am mom to them. I've always been mom to them. That part of my life they don't know, and they don't really want to know about how their mother was terrorized and brutalized and hurt. And truly, being a mother was one of the most wonderful things that I've ever done. The day I was voted president of my son's preschool, which was run by a board, I was like, oh my God, I have passed. I have managed somehow to pass back in. And nobody has picked me out. So I've done a good job. I've done a good job of trying to be like them. And I can honestly say today, I am one of them. A whore is just a butterfly with legs instead of wings. When I go to speak to women who are making the transition off the street, it's very interesting to me because when I come in, of course, they just look like there's nothing you can tell me, nothing that you can say that will move me. And they don't really generally believe people anyway, because when you're on the street, you can't trust anybody. So how do you learn that you can actually trust people and once you make that transition? So when I go in, how I win them over is by showing them that even though I look middle class, I still carry the marks of the street, and I show them the marks of the street. I mean, I have about a 6-inch long a track mark on my arm that can't be disguised. I have a jailhouse tattoo that can't be disguised. My jailhouse tattoo is a little anchor on my ankle. And it's very interesting to me that once they've seen that I'm the real deal, then I can connect to them. I have only been back a couple of times. I just feel so incredibly sad that it's not a place I really ever want to go back to. But when I have been back there, I think, wow, I'm so lucky. I'm so far away from this. Because you can go back there and you still see the desperation, the poverty. I almost see the ghosts of the women that I used to work with. I can feel them still there. To the best of my knowledge, not one of the women that I worked with on the street is still alive. They're all gone. There are no crosses in the cement. No names, birth, or death dates chiseled in stone. No grave or memorial marks where they once stood. No absolution or last rites are granted as they vanish. And no priest or rabbi sifts through the mortar mix to name or bless the prostitutes.
If you'd like to tell your story on Outfront, go to the Outfront website for information on how to pitch to the show. The address is cbc.ca/outfront. Then send us your idea. You can email us at outfront@cbc.ca, or you can send us a letter at Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6.
Thanks for listening to The Best of Outfront. We'll have another podcast next week. Outfront is heard on CBC Radio 1 every Tuesday to Friday at 8:43 p.m. Thanks for listening to Outfront.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.